Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
To the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, we're just 88 days from the end of the Bush presidency, a little less than 2 weeks from the election. Are we all getting electile dysfunction? We need to keep our eyes not just on the election, which is very, very important. We're going to be talking about that a little more today, particularly 12 things you can do to prevent your vote from being stolen. But also the larger issues. For example, what is the American dream? Dan Gaynor, the vice president of the Business and Media Institute and T-Boone Pickens scholar for SAME, Business and Media .org is the website, is with us. And Dan, you've recently written a piece saying that Paul Krugman won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and we should clarify this. This is not actually one of the Nobel Prizes. It's not actually given out by the Nobel organization. It's a prize that was put together, as I recall, in the 1950s, maybe it was the 1960s, by the largest bank in Sweden. And they did it in large part because they wanted to honor Milton Friedman for his radical right-wing economic theories. And ever since then, it has been referred to as the Nobel Prize. But it's actually a prize given by a bank in the memory of Alfred Nobel.
Yeah, it's still called the Nobel in Economics. And yes, they did give it back in the good old days. They did give it to people like Friedman. I would, of course, wildly disagree with your characterization of Milton Friedman's economics. But first of all, I mean, congratulations to Paul Krugman. If you can make a living bashing Bush and then get hailed for your economics as a result, I guess that's the free market of ideas. I just want to know if he's going to take some of his new $1.4 million and voluntarily donate it to government because he thinks taxes are too low.
Well, come on. That's, nice try. But, I mean, he actually won the Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, which is the official title of the prize. He won that for work that he did about 20 years ago on the forces, the economic and geographic forces, and
involving,
say, not since Adam Smith has anybody tried to really pull those two together with regard to trade. And in fact, I disagree with some of the conclusions that he drew, but nonetheless, it had, this was long before George Bush was even governor of Texas.
Right, but so then that makes the timing even more particularly suspect, because I mean, let's face it, here's a guy who makes his living every day pretty much bashing Bush. That's what the New York Times pays him to do. He's possibly one of the most foremost people doing that. Now, you can bash Bush all the days long, and I wouldn't, give a darn. But what he does advocate then in return is pretty much a return to the welfare state. And that's his kind of utopia, would be fair to say. And
well, let's ask that question then, Dan Gaynor with businessandmedia.org. Here's a Republican president. This is Teddy Roosevelt. This is a recording that was personally made by Thomas Edison on his newfangled contraption back when Teddy Roosevelt was president, and he declared what was referred to at the time as the Square Deal. And Franklin Roosevelt took the language, distant third cousin, took the language and reinvented it as the New Deal. But this was Teddy Roosevelt talking about the Square Deal and what he thought every American as a minimum should be entitled to. Now, let's preface this by pointing out, for recreation, for fun on weekends, what I do is I sit around and I read Thomas Jefferson's letters. I'm a Jefferson nerd. What can I say? And he was writing to Madison in 1787, a letter in which he was suggesting that when the Constitution was written, and Madison was on the father of the Constitution. He was the keeper of the notes of the Constitution. Jefferson was suggesting that in the Constitution, that should specifically bar maximum wage laws. Because, as I'm sure you know, Dan, England at that time, in 1787, and some states in the United States, had maximum wage laws. That is, it was illegal to pay a person over a certain amount. Now, that was not for executives. It was not for business owners. It was for average workers. And the reason why was because they wanted to prevent an empowered middle class from emerging. They wanted to keep people, you know, basically, you know, poor, dumb, barefoot, that kind of thing. And you know, that explicitly, that's why England did it. So Teddy Roosevelt, first of all, Jefferson flipped this on his head and said instead we should have a minimum wage law. That never got written in the Constitution either. And it wasn't, and Lincoln talked about it somewhat, first Republican president. And Teddy Roosevelt, here he is, and I'd like to go through this list with you and get your take on, you know, what should be the American dream and what should the average American worker actually earn, since you bring up the issue of the welfare state. Here's Teddy Roosevelt. We stand for a living wage.
Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
So it's subnormal if you know, you can't make a living, basically. He says it does vary from place to place.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
But it does contain certain minimum criteria.
But must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
A normal standard of living.
Standard high enough to make morality possible.
Enough to make morality possible, so you don't have to literally steal food, as so many people did in England and got deported to Australia for it.
To provide for education and recreation.
To provide for education and recreation. You can take a vacation. You can put your kids through high school and college.
To care for immature members of the family.
You can raise your children.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
Cover your health care.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age. Now, how much money do you think, Dan, it takes the average American family to accomplish those things that Republican President Teddy Roosevelt laid out?
I have no idea. I know how much it counted for my parents. So I disagree with a couple things, just to kind of backtrack for a little bit. You talked about Jefferson. Jefferson's the guy also wanted to have you be owner of property, if you know, so you could vote. So,
no, Jefferson never proposed that. In fact,
I can give
you the exact quotes. They were called freeholders, and Jefferson was opposed to the idea that only freeholders should be able to vote.
But you talk about living wage here, because I mean that's one of the things he says. Living wage, which varies from area to area, but then we go around and pass a national minimum wage, which doesn't do that. So,
well, it would presumably reflect the lowest area. So let's take the cheapest living in the United States. You know, I used to live in rural Vermont. It was relatively inexpensive.
Or rural West Virginia. Or Alabama.
Sure,
you could probably find some place.
So in rural West Virginia, in order for somebody to have health care, to be able to put their kids through college, to be able to have a pension, save enough
education.
Money that they can retire. Well,
I mean,
education in the United States, if you want to have any kind of a decent job now, you have to have a college education.
But you said parents
agree?
Putting their kids through college. Well, I mean, why aren't the kids? The kids are adults. At 18, you're an adult.
So you think helping your kids get through college should be only something for people who have wealth?
No, I'm saying we have public schools, and if we didn't have academia going out of control, overcharging people right now.
So then you're suggesting we should do what Jefferson did when he created the University of Virginia and create completely free college education for everybody.
Most people work for education because they're adults. It's what adults do.
So you're suggesting that we should change the minimum wage or mandate lower tuition so that, like my wife Louise, who worked her way through college as a waitress at the Howard Johnson's, I worked my way through college to the extent that I did, working as a DJ at minimum wage, which at that time was, as I recall, $2.35 an hour. You could actually do that back in 1969.
I've got you by a few years going the other direction, so I think minimum wage was a little higher, but I worked during the summers, paying my way through school, and it actually worked at a place that made a little bit more than minimum wage because it was nominally skilled labor.
Do you think that a kid today can put themselves through college at minimum wage?
No, I think a kid today takes out loans, and like any other debt you have.
So you're in favor of people going into debt?
I am in favor of people making their own choices. I've got, you know, worked with several people who've either borrowed and then paid it back, or saved and then gone. I mean, that's my father used to work two jobs so we could afford not just the basic necessities, but to afford more than that.
Isn't there something fundamentally wrong with that, Dan? Shouldn't, as Teddy Roosevelt said, shouldn't people be able to earn a living wage?
No, there's
to spend time with their family.
Fundamentally right with people accomplishing more. People want to work harder, getting further. I mean, that's, frankly, you see it, and traditionally you've always seen this very strongly among immigrant populations in this country. People come to this country and you'll see them work not just the bare minimum, but to work a lot more because they want to make their way. A minimum wage is for minimum skills. It should be, someone, one of the people I know said, should be called a starter wage. And so there's not, you're not deceived into thinking that you should stay at this wage 10 years later. If you're still at a minimum wage and you're 35, then there's something wrong with what you're doing.
Or with the labor marketplace.
No, it's your status in the labor market.
Dan, I think you've done a very good job of representing what the divide is in opinion in America. You know, whether we should, as a society, say the economy is here just for us, or whether we are here for the owners of the economy. Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org. Thanks, Dan.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour, just for the record. And, you know, Dan's a great guy, and usually he gets these things right. So this, I don't mean this to slam Dan, but he said Thomas Jefferson was in favor of freeholders, landholders, being the only ones who could vote, who had the right of self-government, as it was referred to back in the day. And this from a letter by Thomas Jefferson, April 19th, 1824, written from Monticello to John Hampden Pleasance. You can find this if you find the writings of Jefferson. I don't know that it's ever been published anywhere other than the one time in 1909 that his collected works were published, but you may be able to find it. If not, I've got it. And he starts out, he says, "Dear sir, and received the favor of the letter of the 12th, requesting my opinion on the proposition to call a convention for amending the Constitution of the state." And he's talking about how that state, and I'm not sure which state Hampden lived in, but that state did not allow people who were not property owners to vote. And he talks about actually fighting against the state. He says, "It has been said, indeed, that the acquiescence of the people supplied the want of original power." In other words, the state has power if people don't fight back. He says, "But it's a dangerous lesson to say to them, whenever your functionaries exercise unlawful authority over you, if you do not go into actual resistance, it will be deemed acquiescence and confirmation." Quoting this guy. Anyhow, here's the actual statement that has to do with freeholders. He says, "Another defect, which has been corrected by most of the states, is that the basis of our Constitution is in opposition to the principle of equal political rights, refusing to all." In other words, he says, this thing in the Constitution of the states has been fixed. The opposition to the equal political rights, refusing to all but freeholders any participation in the natural right of self-government. In other words, it's a great thing that state by state we're seeing states do away with laws that say you have to own land in order to vote. And Jefferson wrote about this a dozen times or more. So anyhow, the question: how much does it take to have the American dream? Here we have today, you can see this article by Jim Loeb. It's from the Interpress Service, right up at the top of commondreams.org. "Poor rich divide worse among rich countries. The American dream of upward social mobility appears to have emigrated from the United States to Northern Europe, according to a new report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. The United States has the United States, Mexico, and Turkey have the largest gaps between the wealthiest and the poorest in the world. In the world. And therefore, social mobility is the lowest in Mexico, Turkey, and the United States in the world, among developed countries. It is much higher in the Nordic countries," I'm reading from this report, "where income is distributed more evenly. So if the American dream is social mobility, if the American dream is to be able to become a member of the middle class, if the American dream is to be able to have well, literally, social mobility, to have the ability to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, not necessarily to become a multimillionaire or a billionaire, but to be able, as Teddy Roosevelt said, to put your kids through school, to have a vacation every year, to have a pension for your old age, to have savings for your old age, and to make sure that your health care, that you won't be put out of business by an illness. If that's the American dream, and frankly it was from literally the founding of this country, until 1980, when Ronald Reagan said, oh, no, the American dream is to be able to dance at the inaugural ball with a $1,000 Versailles, or however you pronounce it, suit or dress on. I hear Sarah Palin wearing, what, Valentino? I mean, it's like $150,000 for clothes. Yeah, I mean, even at Saks Fifth Avenue, they have a bargain section. Come on. So what is the American dream? Is the American dream to hit the jackpot like Sarah did and have, you know, a political party pay your way, or the beer heiress with $100 million in your back pocket help you out? Is it to win the lottery? Is it to be the one of a very small number of Americans who, through luck and intelligence, you know, I'll acknowledge that. I've been there, done that, have been able to make a lot of money in the business market. Is that the American dream? No, I would submit to you that the American dream is to be able to raise your family, to have a decent and stable home life, to be able to know that sickness is not going to wipe you out, and to be able to know that in old age, as we become increasingly feeble, and I know what this is all about, I'll tell you. Anyhow, as in old age, to know that you're going to be safe. You're going to be safe. You're covered. So here we have, you know, what does it cost? Louise compiled some statistics. Now, keep in mind, the median income in the United States is a little over $50,000 right now. But the average Joe, if you look at the averages of what people spend, it's around $1,600 a month on housing. It's around $1,200 on cars. It's around $440 on child care, $300 a month on health care, $1,200 on food, $200. This is for a family of four. $230 for clothes and personal care, $100 a month on gifts, $152 for travel, $100 in debt payments, $400 a month for savings. That's $70,000 a year before taxes. So that's a $100,000 income. And yet the median income in the United States is a little over $50,000. So this is per family. This is for four people. So what's happening is that people just trying to achieve some sort of a median standard of income. Excuse me. Are going into debt. They're using their homes as ATMs, they're using their credit cards as ATMs, and they're wiping out any possibility of having that lifestyle. I mean, Carl Wolfson this morning was telling me about friends of his who are putting their health care insurance on their credit cards. What's wrong with this picture?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Bush has become president. 5 million people have slipped into poverty. 8 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Median household income has gone down $1,300. 3 million manufacturing jobs have been lost. 3 million Americans have lost their pensions. Home foreclosures are now the highest on record, higher than any time since the Great Depression. The personal savings rate is below zero, which hasn't happened since the Great Depression. Real earnings of college graduates have dropped 5% since Bush came into office. Entry-level wages for male and high school and female high school graduates fallen over 3% since George Bush came into office. Wages and salaries are now the lowest share of GDP since 1929. Uh-oh. I'm telling you, it's our pigeon alert. German railway engineers believe they have solved the mystery of what caused last Friday's nationwide disruptions of the railway service. I'm telling you, this proves that pigeons are actually robots on the planet Xenu here to spy on us. And even now, they've gone to the point of becoming little terrorists. They're disrupting things. Think of the planning that went into this. This, an unlucky pigeon is believed to have caused nationwide disruptions in the German rail system last Friday by unwittingly causing a short circuit when it landed on a 15,000-volt overhead power line. Now, a total of 200 trains across Germany were delayed, some severely. The accident led to an automatic cutout of the power supply to several other railroad tracks for 6 hours, causing an aggregate total of 62 hours of delays on various train routes. Over 200 trains all across Germany shut down. You tell me that didn't require a lot of planning and thought by that pigeon. I'm telling you, you never see baby pigeons, you never see dead pigeons, because they are robots. They're here spying on us. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Is it Tanis or Tanis in Washougal?
How are you?
Hi. How do you pronounce your name?
Tanis.
Tanis.
Yes.
Thank you for calling. What's up?
Well, you know, I was listening to your last guest, and I got so upset I had to call, and I never have before. I listen all the time. But I do some volunteer work with teen moms. Most of them are kind of from the inner city.
Mm-hmm.
And last week I was driving one of my girls home, and she's trying to get on track. She's applying to college, and she's got a new job. And we were talking, and I was saying, you know, if you can just put a little of that money aside, just pretend you never got it, and, you know, in a while you'll save up something that will really help you and your son. And she's like, well, I was able to do that, but last month our power got turned off, and we were going to get evicted. And I had to give it to my mom. And I just started listening to her, and she's telling me how her mom works full-time. Her brother, who's trying to go to school, works part-time. And she's working part-time, and she's 17, and her brother's 19. And she said that they tried so hard not to go on any welfare, but they finally did, because after they'd pay their rent and their bills, they had $34 a month left over for food. Her mom doesn't have any health care. She does, because she's a minor. So for someone to say that, you know, the minimum wage, I mean, these are people who are all working, and they are paid minimum wage jobs, and they simply are not making it by any measure. I have $34 a month for groceries. I don't even know what you'd buy. She told me she has one pair of pants, you know, and I was just, there's something wrong. And then, you know, I think that shortly before that, we've been having all the talk about Joe the plumber. I'm thinking, we're very concerned about all these business owners, but this is a segment of our population that is forgotten. People would rather just write a check and not have to deal with it, if they even do that. But they don't want to see that. They don't want to touch it. They don't want to go near it. And it's wrong, you know. I feel like we should all be paying a little bit more to help these people, because they're trying, they're working. And,
well, that's one
food.
Way to do it, Tanis. Another way to do it is to simply say, if you're going to have a functioning business in this country, and this is what they say in most of the northern European countries, if you're going to have a functioning business in this country, you must pay your workers enough that they can actually live
mm-hmm.
on the paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that simple. When every business that I've started, I've had to go to the Secretary of State of the state in which I lived and apply for a license, apply for the right to shift
sure.
liability away from myself and onto a corporate entity.
So, right.
And a lot of benefits come with that. Tax benefits come with that. I mean, all kinds of benefits and actual rights come
mm-hmm.
with creating a corporation. And in exchange for that, as a society, we should say, okay, you want to be able to make a lot of money running a company, you want to take a chance on that, and you know, God bless you, it's a great thing, here's what you have to do. You have to make sure that the people working for you are paid enough that they can actually live.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reason why we're giving these rights to individuals to create corporations is to help society, not just so that a small 1% of Americans can become incredibly filthy rich.
Exactly, and I think that is the paradigm that has taken over.
It is, absolutely. Ever since Ronald Reagan, we have come to the conclusion that the reason people start businesses is to get rich, number one, and number two, that's the American dream, to start a business.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, you can't have everybody in America being an independent businessman. It wouldn't be possible, number one. and number two, the purpose of an economy in every other country in the world, it seems, or most of the other developed countries, those who haven't had Friedmanism inflicted on them, and Friedrich von Hayek and all this right-wing Thatcherism and Reaganomics, haven't had that inflicted on them, they get it, that the purpose for an economy is to serve the people.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why we, the people, as a government, say we are going to cut all these breaks to you if you start a business is because starting that business will have, A, primarily some benefit to society, and B, as secondarily, will give you an opportunity to get rich. Tanis, thank you very much for sharing this.
Oh, well, thank you, Tom. I loved your show. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. It's just a powerful reminder. The average family in the United States, what does it take to live? What does it take to live in America? It depends, obviously, on where you live. You know, if you live in Appalachia, it's different than if you live in San Francisco. But it's you know, if the median income in the United States is $52,000 a year, and it looks like that's the neighborhood, that's the median income. And we know that the median family in America is slipping into debt massively, and has been for the last 15 or 20 years, then we know that it costs, that it takes a whole lot more than $52,000 a year to live in the United States, or at least to live at the standard at which we Americans have become accustomed to. And so what do we do? Do we recalibrate the standard? Do we say, okay, nationally, we're all going to just become poorer? Or do we say we're going to recalibrate the standard of wages? And people say, wow, wait a minute. If companies have to pay more in wages, what are they going to do? They're going to raise their prices. Well, to some extent, yeah, in small part. And I don't mind paying 5 or 10% more for my stuff if I'm getting 20 or 30% more in my paycheck. And that's how it would work, because the majority of that wage increase is not going to be reflected in an increase in prices. As Ronald Reagan pointed out on this program yesterday, where he pointed out how in 1948 Standard Oil's profits had gone up 70% and prices were rising, but wages were not. And he said very clearly, this proves the price increases are the result of increased corporate profits. What will happen if wages go up is that corporate profits will go down, dividends will go down, which means the wealthy class, that 1% of Americans, that less than 1% of Americans who make their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail every month and pay a maximum 15% income tax on that, they're going to make less money. And that's fine with me. I'll be just right on record saying that's fine with me. Gina in Portland. Hey, Gina.
Hi. I wanted to comment just on how much the American dream has changed from the time that my grandparents, you know, were able to bring up seven kids on one income to today.
Sure.
Because I think a lot of people families lived close to each other. There wasn't this long distance traveling. An exotic vacation might be two states over, and that was a long distance. They weren't looking to have seven televisions I think that the quantity of stuff that people wanted was much different than what it is today. The desire in what was included in quote unquote the American dream was a lot different.
You know, Gina, for the middle class, for those people who are earning above the median income in the United States and are still living in debt, and I know some of those, we all know some of those folks who are making $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year, and they've still got $10,000 in their credit cards, and they've cashed out their houses if it was an ATM machine. Those folks need to recalibrate their lifestyle.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And I think we also have to acknowledge that there are probably, it depends on whose numbers you're looking at, a minimum of 20 million families in the United States and possibly as many as 50 million families in the United States, which is about a third of all the families in this country, who are living so far below $52,000 a year that they have never, ever thought about an exotic vacation. They don't have seven televisions, and they're not leasing a new car and using credit cards. They're really living on something between minimum wage and that $50,000 a year. They're the people that our previous caller was talking about.
No, I'm in complete agreement. And it's also a difference in the way industry conducted business here, because I think there was someone that did a study on the Jack and Jill books, mm-hmm. the readers.
Right.
And comparing the last reader that was put out, because I think they no longer use that one, to the one of the first ones, was they discovered a whole bunch of differences in values in wanting one doll versus wanting two. And I think also that whole kind of propaganda, the media with the propaganda in saying you need these things. It wasn't
right.
That bad back then.
We've even seen a change in television. Pre-1980, the average family portrayed on television was living in an average home. You know, Lucille Ball lived in a cheap apartment in New York City. Jackie Gleason lived in a fourth floor walk-up with cold water. And after Reagan came in and we started celebrating wealth, you saw Frasier living in a multi-million-dollar penthouse.
Yep.
So we've completely recalibrated. It's the squirrel story. Gina, thank you very much. I'll tell you the squirrel story after we come back from the break, and we'll pick up more of your calls, 866-303-2270. What is the American dream? And what are the standards by which we should live in America as we stand at this historic moment? And I believe we literally are standing at an historic moment like we were in 1930, where we really can change it all.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
But it wasn't enough to do the things that I most love. So my mama and my papa sold all their property, 'cause they knew how much it meant to me. I loaded up the pickup and I bid them farewell. I promised I would pay back every cent. All of the money will be well spent. I'm gonna run for president. I'm gonna run, run.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Downright strange stuff out there, I'm telling you. Yeah, Alan Greenspan, our conservative alert for the day. I guess we have two of them. You can see over at Huffington Post a picture of Piper. That's the 7-year-old daughter of Governor Palin with a Louis Vuitton bag. Anyhow, here's Alan Greenspan testifying before Congress this morning, and he said... I've got the AP story sitting here in my hand. It says Greenspan, who headed the nation's central bank for 18 years, said in testimony prepared for Congress that he and others who believed lending institutions would do a good job of protecting their shareholders are in a state of shocked disbelief. That's a verbatim quote from Alan Greenspan, that he is in a state of shocked disbelief.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
Good heavens! And let me just tell you how this stuff gets spun, and then I'll tell you the squirrel story. This from the front page of yesterday's Wall Street Journal. The headline, Argentina makes grabs for pensions amid crisis. This is the right-wing take on it. Buenos Aires, Dateline Buenos Aires, hemmed in by the global financial squeeze and commodity slump, Argentina's leftist government has seemingly found a novel way to find the money to stay afloat, cracking open the piggy bank in the nation's private pension system. The government proposed to nationalize the private pensions, which would provide it with much of the cash it needs to meet debt payments and avoid a second default this decade. Okay. Now, here's from the Financial Times, the rest of the story. The private pension funds, or AFJPs, were created in 1994. What happened was, in 1994, in order to get IMF money, Argentina had to do away with their social security system, say, you're on your own, we're privatizing social security. So everybody went to a privatized program in Argentina, and as the Financial Times, not the Wall Street Journal, points out, quote, but the value, so the private pension funds, which were created in 1994, are the country's largest institutional investors, with 55% of funds invested in Argentine government debt, 11% in the domestic stock market. But the value of their investments has tumbled 40% this year. So it's not that Argentina is going to make public, they're going to go back to a social security system because they need to grab that money. It's that people have lost 40% of their pensions because they were privatized in 94 because of right-wing ideology. In fact, here, the private pension system was created as an alternative to state pension funds in 1994 when conservative President Carlos Saul Menem ran Argentina and free market policies were in vogue in Latin America. Countries in the region followed the example of Chile, which had privatized pensions in 1981. Okay, the squirrel story. Years ago, and I've been looking for the source on this, I haven't been able to find it, but years ago, there was a study that was done that found where they, you know, squirrels, this was, I believe it was red squirrels, that squirrels typically have a standard size nest, and they had gone into a neighborhood, and, you know, they make their nests out of leaves. They'd gone into a neighborhood, and they had expanded the size of a couple of squirrels' nests by 20%. And what they found was that all the other squirrels in the neighborhood all expanded the size of their nests by 20% to keep up with the Joneses of the squirrels whose nests had been larger. It's probably a biological impulse. If some squirrels are making bigger nests, they must know that a cold winter is coming. I better get ready. But it's a biological impulse that we have been buying into, and it's how commercial television, it's how seeing the Frasers on TV with the multi-million-dollar penthouses rather than the Jackie Gleasons with the fourth-floor cold water walk-up causes us to say, oh, gee, we've got to have that house. And so, anyhow, that's my rant on that. Gary in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Yes, sir. Hi. Preface my comments by saying that hopefully some of those patriotic corporations that move plant equipment and manufacturing jobs overseas, maybe they'll go bankrupt as demand dries up.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
But my comment was 2 days ago the OECD issued a report that covered 30 nations over 20 years.
Yeah, that's the one I was quoting at the beginning of the show, that we're the United States, Turkey, and Mexico now have the highest ratio, the highest disparity of wealth between the richest and the poorest in the world.
Right, and it said out of those 30 countries, at 26 of them, the gap is widening.
That's right.
And
those are the countries that have embraced what's referred to in Europe as neoliberalism or Thatcherism, and what we refer to as Reaganomics. You're absolutely right, Gary. And it's over the top. It is really, really destructive to the United States. It really is. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Tom. I'd like to take a crack at reconciling this issue with Joe the plumber and the small business versus the median income guy.
Yeah.
All small businesses are dependent upon customers walking in and out of their door.
That's right.
And if you put more money in the customer's hands, in the small guy's hands, the small businesses have a chance. Without that, with this elitist sort of tax structure that they're talking about, there's just no way.
That's absolutely right. Small businesses, just like all business, frankly, depend on the middle class. The economy is driven from the bottom up. Thank you for that. Yesterday, Limbaugh was going off on, a bunch of obviously, set up callers. I'm a businessman and I'm laying off people because I'm seeing an Obama economy coming. Come on, give me a break. If you're laying off people, it's because the economy's bad. If you're hiring people, it's because there's demand for your product. Period. Rich people don't create jobs because they want to create jobs. They don't create jobs because they got a tax cut. I've created, to use that terminology, probably 200 or 300 jobs in my lifetime. And in aggregate over the years, all the companies that I've started, it's probably been thousands of jobs. I never once actually created a job. I hired people to do things because I knew that I could make more money on their work than their work cost me. That's how businesses operate. If I can make $100,000 a year off somebody's labor and I can get that person to work for $50,000 a year, then I've got a business. If it costs me $50,000 a year to hire somebody and I can only get $40,000 a year for their labor, then I don't have a business. It's real simple. This is not rocket science. There's not a lot of math involved in this. People don't create jobs. In fact, the whole phrase, job creation, should be stricken from our vocabulary because it's a lie. What creates jobs is demand. And demand is driven by people having decent wages. Living wages, so that they're buying things and somebody comes along and says, hey, I'll make those things for them to buy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our show. Tom Hartman here with you. And Madeleine Albright served as U.S. Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001, the first woman ever to hold that position. Her distinguished career in government includes positions in the National Security Council on Capitol Hill and as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Madeleine Albright, Madam Secretary, welcome to our program.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Very pleased to have you with us. About 3 or 4 years ago, I was invited to speak at Oxford University on the subject of a book I'd written on corporate power called Unequal Protection. And, it's a great honor to be invited to speak at Oxford. And there were, 250, 300 students and faculty in the room. And I stood up to talk about this rather arcane topic. And they basically heckled me for the first minute or two, wanting to know my opinion on George Bush. And it wasn't, and the war in Iraq. And it wasn't until I publicly disavowed my own president. And it wasn't until I said I did not vote for the man. I do not like the man. I think his policies stink. And I think the war is a disaster and a mistake. And I got a standing ovation for saying it, that they would then let me go on with a discussion about an 1886 Supreme Court decision. And I was frankly shocked by that. I've done a lot of international speaking over the years. America's standing, and this is an ally of ours, right? America's standing in the world is in the toilet. You have been Secretary of State. I'm sure that you have seen this and must be watching the same thing with horror. What do, first of all, is my experience reflected in your experience around the world? And secondly, if so, what do we do about it?
Well, first of all, your experience, I have had it too, and I was at Oxford too. It's very daunting place, I have to admit, isn't it?
Yes.
But
you can't get away with anything.
No,
they do not suffer fools gladly.
I do think that the sad part is that everything we know and in personal experience, the U.S. is not respected. And you know, what's interesting, Tom, is I think people could kind of deal or explain the 2000 election to themselves somehow. It was close. There were mistakes made. What they didn't understand was how the United States could reelect George Bush in 2004. So all of a sudden, the polling data that we had seen, and I've been involved with the Pew surveys, they had liked the American people and didn't like our policies, but after 2004, they kind of mushed us all together. So
yeah,
that was a problem. I think the hardest part, and you must have felt this too, and I certainly feel it as a former public official, is to go and try not to be disparaging of the president when you're abroad.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very difficult part because you kind of think, all right, you feel like a patriotic American and you want to defend your country. And it's really, in my case, not good form to be critical of the president.
Sure.
But it is, it's a very sad case, which is why I'm so glad we're going to have a new president, because it is important to our national interest that we are not in this kind of a position abroad.
Right. And to that point, you have a new book out, Memo to the President. It was previously published as Memo to the President-elect. It's out in paperback, new updated edition, the subtitle, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. It's a marvelous book, Madam Albright, Madam Secretary.
Thank
and,
you.
And I love the story where Annie Oakley, what was her name? Phoebe Ann Moses.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Wrote a letter to William McKinley in 1898 saying that she would offer 50 lady sharpshooters, but she expected that he would keep us out of war, but if necessary. And then on the page after that, you quote Herbert Hoover, who was actually, you know, I think ultimately his work with the Roosevelt administration sort of redeemed his reputation. Anyhow, he quoted his Quaker uncle saying, turn the other cheek once, but if he smites you again, then punch him. In other words, we this idea of preemptive war as opposed to responsive war is a really radical and new thing in American history.
Well, it is. But, you know, the whole thing with the preemption doctrine is that it was so unnecessary. Because the bottom line is every country under the UN Charter is able to defend itself. And when George Bush put this doctrine into place, he complicated life in terms of generally how we are regarded. And then just imagine if every country in the world decided that it would preempt on the basis of inaccurate information. I mean, that is the Achilles heel of the whole thing, which is if you don't have intelligence, then you really run into creating wars where they are unnecessary.
Well, and this is why we have the UN. This is, you know, the whole point of the UN is to be able to make your case before the international body.
Absolutely. I mean, I am sure you would agree we have a right to defend ourselves. That is
kind
of
standard.
Oh, yeah,
and I think it's Article 30 of the UN Charter, isn't it?
You can do that. And so that's why making a doctrine out of it was such a complicating factor.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not been a good thing for us. In your book, you talk about how to isolate. In fact, you have an entire chapter dedicated to the isolation of Al-Qaeda. Certainly, Bill Clinton, when he was president, did a very good job of isolating our largest domestic terrorist during his time, Tim McVeigh, and the right-wing militia movement or the separatist movement within the United States that McVeigh was associated with. What are your thoughts on isolating Al-Qaeda?
Well, I think we have to take a different approach. First of all, we can't kind of lump everybody who doesn't like us into the Al-Qaeda network because we enlarge it. And the interesting thing is when I was Secretary of State, I was basically told not to talk about Osama bin Laden so much because it made him larger than life. And I think that we have to figure out what we're really talking about in terms of Al-Qaeda, not to make warriors out of them, to realize that ultimately the solution to this kind of extremism has to be solved within the Muslim community itself, and try to figure out what the roots of people's discontent is. It's not easy. I would not call it a war on terror because it makes warriors out of murderers, but I think we have to be smarter in terms of trying to figure out who we're dealing with and how to separate those that are not part of that group.
I would submit to you that Karl Rove understood the basic lesson that every fiction writer and every screenwriter learns, which is that in an epic story, the good character, the protagonist's goodness, is always defined almost exclusively by how evil the antagonist is. So Superman would be a very boring story if there wasn't Lex Luthor. Batman would be a very boring story if there wasn't a supervillain, you know, the Juggler or the, you know, whatever, the Joker. And so George Bush, with his ratings in the tank, essentially had to create an anti-superhero, and he did so in Osama bin Laden, and it's been, and allowed him to be the superhero, George Bush. And that storyline, that narrative, which Republicans are still trying to cling to, has been actually destructive to our efforts around the world.
I so agree with you. I think it's a very good analysis. I think that dividing the world in this particular way and the axis of evil and just the language that's used has created all kinds of problems. I think the interesting part was if you go back to 9/11, the world was with us. There's no question about it.
Right.
And then when, as a result of the kind of terminology and trying to widen the support for us after 9/11 into hatred of everybody else, I think undermined the support that we have abroad. And that's not the real life. I mean, that's why you talk about it as science fiction or fiction generally, because there are many areas of gray in between. And it doesn't prove anything to decide you're absolutely not going to talk to people because you disagree with them.
I'm curious, Madam Secretary, we're talking with Madam Albright. She has a new book out, or new updated edition, and it's absolutely great reading. New York Times bestseller, Memo to the President, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership, and you know, worth picking up. Madam Secretary, I'm curious what your recommendations would be, since this is a memo to the President. Should Barack Obama, God willing, be elected president of the United States, what your recommendations would be to him with regard to, at the very least, the position that you held in the cabinet of the Clinton administration Secretary of State?
Well, I'm not going to name names because we first have to get him elected. But
yeah.
I think the bottom line is, and I talk about this in the book in the first part, is that it's very important that whoever is Secretary of State and the others create a good team. I think that's an important part. But I hope very much that what a President Obama would do is to select people with diverse points of view so that he is presented with a variety of ideas and then goes into the Oval Office and makes up his mind based on his knowledge and principles, judgment, and wisdom. But you don't want a bunch of people who say yes sir, yes sir, and then you get something like what we have now. And so I would hope that there would be variety. I also hope that the next Secretary of State is someone who understands, first of all, what a great job it is, but how difficult it is, and that he or she is going to need help in terms of special envoys and people that are able to deal with the whole host of issues that are out there.
I very, very well said. And citing Doris Kern Goodwin's book on Lincoln, I think Obama has indicated that that's the direction he's going to go. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Memo to the President is her book, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. Madam Secretary, thank you so much for being
great
with us today.
Great. Tom, thanks for your kind words about the book. Bye.
Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back.
21 minutes past the hour. The True People's Radio. Tom Hartman Show with you. And remember when Barack Obama made the bitter comment last April? He said those people in Pennsylvania, they're kind of hanging on to their guns and their religion. Well, here's a verbatim quote from Karl Rove last night on Hannity and Combs. He said, and I quote, "But it's a conservative part of the state, Pennsylvania. And then if you take the far southwest corner over there near Pittsburgh in the suburbs, that's coal country. And that's the kind of people who really do cling to their guns and their faith." End quote. Now he really said it. Alan Combs caught him on it. Sean Hannity, nothing to say. Nothing to say. Oh, my. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see, Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the McCain effect.
Okay.
You know, they've talked about the Bradley effect. Well, I think there are many, probably hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Americans who are going to go to vote. And if they were called by a pollster and asked who they're going to vote for, they'd be afraid not to say McCain for fear of being called ageist. Now, every time the issue of age comes up, the McCain campaign goes berserk. And what I want to suggest is there's millions and millions of Americans who will not say they're going to vote against McCain, but when they get in that voting booth, they're going to think, whoa, he's too old.
Yeah, and she's too lightweight, let's say. Ian, I think you're onto something here. And you know, there's a whole lot of ways that the polls, I think, are all screwed up. 60, for example, the AP poll, the most recent AP poll, showed, you look at their analysis, who they were questioning, 68% of the people that they questioned were married, 34% were Southerners, and 44% were evangelicals. But in the 2000 election and the 2004 election, now keep in mind, they had 68% married voters who were more likely to be Southerners and evangelicals, 68%. In the 2000 election, only 57% of all the people who voted were married. And in the 2004 election, only 58% of all the people who voted were married. Yet AP is polling 68%, 10% more married people, who would be presumably, you know, arguably more likely to be, quote, conservative or be, you know, socially conservative or whatever the phrase is. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Chris, I've lost my connection to the call screen software, so if you can, you know, pop up, let's see, Debbie in Portland, Oregon on line 8 there, I'd appreciate it. Hey, Debbie.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air. What's up? Are you attaining the American dream, Debbie?
No. But I do make pretty good money. I work at Nabisco and make a good living.
What do you think should be a minimum wage in the United States?
Oh, at least $15 an hour. I make $22 an hour, and it by myself, I struggled.
Yeah.
The only time I ever got ahead was when I got married, and
I
had
think,
two incomes.
I think we're about 10-1 from 1960, from the 1960s, because you know, both Louise and I were making less than $3 an hour, and we were able to put ourselves through college doing that. And so today, I'd say it would be just under $30 an hour. But in any case, that's not what you call it.
Yeah, but I'm just saying at least 15, and it's only 8 here in Oregon.
Yeah.
You know. But what I called about was I was watching CNN while I was listening to you, and on the bottom of the screen it said that U.S. warns Iraq to accept security agreement.
Right.
Now, I've been reading Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine.
Yep.
And so now I'm really suspicious about everything I see on TV. But what do you think about that?
Debbie, I think, and I, you know, thank you for raising that, and I appreciate the call. I think that the what we're seeing here is the shock doctrine writ large. I think this is disaster capitalism. I think Iraq was part of it. I think Katrina was part of it. I think, frankly, this economic meltdown is part of it. Whether you know planned or unplanned, whether intentional or unintentional, it's opportunities for basically greedy economic predators to sweep in. Thanks a lot for the call. Stan on line 2 in Jacksonville, Florida, listening on 105.7.
Yeah,
hey, Stan.
Stan in Jacksonville. Two quick things, one of which you just covered, but I'd like to give a probably statewide example that may be national of Republican Party hate tactics. My wife is a registered independent who, I'm proud to tell you, for the first time in her life went to a political rally for Obama and has voted for him already, she assures me. But in the last 5 days, not counting today, last 5 days, she's received three pieces of hate mail attacking Obama. Not the most vicious I've ever seen, but truly hate mail. One came out of the Republican National Committee in Washington, D.C. with a "I'm John McCain and I approve this ad," and the other two came from the state Democratic Party headquarters. So they're targeting independents.
You mean the Republican Party headquarters?
The Republican Party is sending, has gotten the independent mailing list, which are obviously public record, and are using this three times in 5 days is pretty obvious. Secondly, I want to point out that along with the scam, I think AP's poll scam you already covered a few minutes ago, that is right now the lead story on the AOL newsletter.
Interesting. Stan, thanks for the heads up. Appreciate it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Not be pretty, and my clothes are not the best, and there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
34 minutes past the hour, Truth in Broadcasting here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Ah, yes, John McCain says...
changed. You know, I love it when they say, oh, McCain has changed. And I say, what have I changed on? They can't name a single issue. Or they'll name an issue and it's false. I'm the same guy. I'm proud of our campaign.
Yeah, well, okay. So McCain says he's never flip-flopped. What about his flip-flop on attacking terrorists in Pakistan, on defense spending, on the detention of detainees, on Don Rumsfeld, on Henry Kissinger, on illegal wiretapping, on the Law of the Sea Convention, on long-term troop presence in Iraq, on negotiations with Hamas, on negotiations with Syria, on normalization of relations with Cuba, on nuclear reactors, on nuclear waste storage at Yucca Mountain, on the rogue state rollback, on torture, on the 21st century GI Bill, on ethanol, on Everglades restoration, on offshore drilling, on criticizing the media, on Katrina investigations, on lobbyists, on the Wiley brothers, on the AIG bailout, on Americans live better under Bush, on balancing the budget, on the Bush tax cuts, on earmarks for Arizona, on the fairness of the estate tax, on job losses for Michigan, on Social Security privatization, on tobacco industry private regulations, on the windfall profits tax, on comprehensive immigration reform, on the Confederate flag, on Jerry Falwell and the religious right, on the NRA, on teaching intelligent design, on the gay marriage amendment, on abortion exceptions, on repealing Roe v. Wade. And on taxpayer funding for contraception in Africa. How about those, John McCain, your 44 flip-flops that thinkprogress.org so far has documented? This is totally, totally weird. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Drew in Cape May, New Jersey. Hey, Drew, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the American dream. I know you were talking about that earlier, and yeah. I don't think anyone's American dream is to work in a cubicle and push paper around for some financial institution and not make money. You know, the whole financial crisis was about getting people into homes. But, you know, our education system has it so that we're just teaching people to work in cubicles. We don't teach people how to maintain their homes. You know, I actually have a conversation often with people about how I think every student should be able to build something by the time they get out of high school. You know, maybe start a birdhouse or doghouse. By the time they graduate high school, I think they should be able to.
Yeah, I remember, you know, shop class, it's amazing to me that kids graduate from high school not knowing how to do two things that most will end up doing, which is change a diaper and balance a checkbook.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
or negotiate a mortgage loan or make sense out of a credit card. Are you attaining the American dream, Drew?
Well, actually, I do. I own actually two homes, but you know, when I got my first home, I didn't know how to do anything. You know, I had to call people to help me out. I had to teach myself how to sweat pipes and how to do stuff, because I can't afford to call someone every time, you know, the toilet clogs.
Right.
And, you know, my kids, I wish I could teach my kids how to, you know, fix a lawnmower or the stuff, but, you know, my parents both worked.
Yeah.
And they couldn't come home after work, or they're working two jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And start teaching me how to do these things. And granted, I was able to find these things after myself, but a lot of parents, a lot of kids, I mean, there's a book called How Stupid Are We? I mean, I think two out of five Americans know what the three branches of government are.
Yeah.
You know,
I have a feeling, Drew, that the generation coming up right now, the kids in their teens and 20s and even probably in their early 30s, are, as a consequence of this economic disaster brought to us by 26 years of Reaganomics and Thatcheronomics and Friedmanomics and, you know, right-wing ideology, that they are going to, you know, perhaps tragically, maybe for the best thing, if you look at it in a generational context, are going to learn those skills that you're talking about. I know exactly what you're talking about, and thank you for saying it. It's very well said. Dylan in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Dylan, are you achieving the American dream?
I was calling about Obama leaving the campaign trail.
Okay, sure.
I think I was noticing today that Obama leaving the campaign trail is so interesting, just because he's leaving the campaign trail to see his ailing grandmother, but yet McCain was leaving the campaign trail to fix the economy, and it was just it was interesting to see the dichotomy between McCain ticket calling itself the populist ticket, but yet going to fix America's problems, economic problems, but yet Obama really is more in touch with what's really important to people, and that's family. And that's,
yeah, his grandmother, you know, is apparently dying,
yeah.
Or very close to it. She's 86, I think. And by the way, she and her husband are white people. Oh my God!
Right, exactly.
This is another thing that's amazing to me, is how many people in America refer to Obama as black, and he is actually half black, half white. And
right.
I think we should have a conversation in this country too about the fact that increasingly Americans are not any one particular race. We are becoming a brown nation, I think it's a good and healthy thing, frankly, and he's the synthesis of that. Excellent point. Dylan, are you hitting the American dream?
Am I? You know, I'm in school.
Yeah? So you're going, are you doing it on debt, or are you able to put yourself through school?
You know, I have a scholarship. I'm living the American dream as best as I can, but I'm following my own path, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, well, I wish you well. Thank you very much for the call, Dylan. Great to hear from you. Aldous in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Aldous, what's on your mind?
Hey there. You know that Washington Times poll that shows Obama and McCain all neck and neck, right?
Right.
That's bugging me. I think it's a plant.
Yeah, it's a setup for a stolen election so that they can say, see, we told you.
Well, exactly, because, I mean, all the other polls, every other one is showing Obama so far ahead, and so this really does, this just allows them to have the cover to say, well, you know, not all the polls said that,
yeah.
And the Washington Times, of course, was set up, you know, by Sun Yat-sen, so this is a conservative hack paper to begin with.
Right, yeah, you're absolutely right. Aldous, thank you very much. Well said and spot on. Absolutely. Kim in San Francisco. Hey, Kim.
Hey, ask me if I have the American dream.
Okay, do you have the American dream, Kim?
No, I don't, because my daughter was not an academic. You know, the thing that bugs me about what we value in this country is that you better be an academic. Not everybody is gifted in studies. We all have different gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are better in the arts. Some people are better at theater. Some people are better at other things that don't necessarily make you rich. And my daughter happened to be one of them. Mm-hmm. And because she's not an academic and because she had a lot of problems with her studies, I'm saving up and hoping with what's left of my retirement that we can leave her something, because she's not going to have a lot of economic opportunities now. She's a good worker. She's intelligent. She's funny. She's charming. But she's not an academic. So, no, I don't have the American dream. She will
yeah,
not
and this
live
is,
better
this
than,
is,
I, than
this
I
is
did.
The thing. I mean, it's crazy to have an economy where you assume that the only way a person can actually hit the middle class in the United States is to go to college.
because there are so many things that need to be done. I mean, yes, we have exported a lot of these jobs, and yes, we have brought people in from other countries to do a lot of these jobs, and both of those things are destroying the American middle class.
You bet.
Because we used to do our own construction work. It used to be a good job to be a union carpenter, you know, for example, and,
sure
and you could raise a family doing that. And that has been largely decimated by immigration that started with Reagan's 1983 amnesty, or was it 86? I forget which
year. Which is what it was designed to do. The Reagan amnesty started it.
Yeah, to bust the middle class, number one. And number two, all these jobs going overseas. And we really need to honor work again in this country and say that, you know, if you work in a tool and die shop, if you work on an auto assembly line, if you work making televisions, although we don't make televisions in the United States anymore, or if you work making computers, although we don't make computers anymore, or if you work making clothing, although we don't make clothing in the United States anymore.
Tennis shoes.
Yeah.
Shoes at all.
There you go. Yeah. You know, Levi Strauss closed their last blue jeans factory in the United States about 4 years ago.
Which was here in San Francisco.
That's right. That's right.
The other thing I wanted to say is that in my opinion, and, you know, what do I know, but it's just my opinion, is the minimum wage is nothing more than government-sanctioned and supported poverty. Now, the thing that people...
That's what it's become. That's not what it was originally intended as.
No, it was not. But to see, the deal is... Once we get these laws passed, and this goes to all of us, because, you know, knock on wood, it looks like we have a good chance of winning this election. They don't give us things like weekends off. The Congress and our government doesn't give these things. We got weekends off. We got safer workplaces. We got minimum wage because people fought for it.
You're right. Fought and died for it in the union movement.
If we win everything, don't expect largesse from our government.
You're right. It doesn't come from the top down. It comes from the bottom up. And that's why, you know, on Guy Fawkes Day, November 5th, that's the day that we must begin the work of taking back this government and taking back this country in a very positive and peaceful way, unlike Guy Fawkes.
What Guy Fawkes is? It's also November 5th is also the birthday of Eugene Debs. And my birthday! Woo!
Congratulations, Kim.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot for the call. Happy birthday, Guy Fawkes Day. And Eugene Debs, who would have thought? I didn't know that. That is absolutely great. But that's the bottom line. Kim is so right. If we don't start taking political action, if we don't get involved, it's not going to come from the top down. You know, Roosevelt didn't do it because he was a good guy. He did it because the people were mobilized. Because you had the Bonus Army out there protesting against Hoover. You had, you know, America was mobilized against the Republicans and they turned out to vote for a Democrat. And then they kept the heat on. And that's what we have to do, is keep the heat on. We need to use political pressure to get a more progressive agenda passed.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Jackson Brown, 9 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. Brad Friedman is with us, bradblog.com, one of the best sites for everything that's going on regarding these stolen elections, all these, yay, these long, many years. Hey, Brad, welcome.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Just fine. Thanks for providing us with our regular electile dysfunction update. Here, and in fact, we even have our theme music for it.
Just a touch of a screen. Welcome to the future. Come try our voting machine.
So, Brad, what's the state of the nation here with regard to the voting machines and the elections and all this other kind of stuff?
Well, you know, it's very precarious. The obviously, as you know, this Acorn voter fraud nonsense, this hoax over the last week or two, has really distracted from the real concerns being on the front end, the vote purges, the voting roll purges that are going on all over the country.
It's been over a million in New York State, over 100,000 in Colorado, and well, you have the numbers.
Yeah, no, and I think that's going to, well, I mean, you could go through state after state with those numbers, illegal folks who were illegally purged, many of them. I think that's going to be the November surprise when people show up and find they're not registered at all to vote. But all of that has served to obscure the concerns about the voting machines that we've been warning about for so many years, and that's starting to rear its ugly head, to no one's surprise, I suppose, once again, down in Florida. The machines are breaking down, and these are paper ballot machines, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But it had the effect of, for example, holding up a CNN reporter, John Zarella, for 3 hours because they've got these print-on-demand ballot machines now made by Diebold, our old friends. They weren't working, and when they were working, they were printing out ballots that couldn't properly be scanned. So in the second day of early voting, there were three-hour-long lines. And
how is it, Brad, that Diebold can make an ATM that's absolutely 100% solid, rock-solid, reliable, and are used by banks all over the world, and yet when they make a voting machine, it doesn't work?
Because people actually test those ATMs, and they have money in them, and people take money seriously, and if they gave out the wrong amount of money, there would be hell to pay, they would shut them down, there'd be fraud investigations, there would be everything else. When it comes to the voting machines, there's no oversight, there's nobody who gives a damn, and when folks like you and I mention that there is, for years, of course, you know, we were called crazy and, you know, tinfoil hat wearers, and yeah. So, but, you know, the fact is we were right then, we're right now, and we're seeing these problems again and again. And, notably, the first machines that we see that are starting to flip again, and we saw this in 2006 over and over in state after state. We're seeing these ESNS touchscreen machines now flipping in several. So far, I think we've got just a fourth county came in now in West Virginia where people are trying to vote for Obama. Their vote is flipping to to John McCain. We're seeing it down in Tennessee as well on the same ESNS iVotronic machines in Nashville. And got a report yesterday, thankfully, that the machines are now flipping reportedly in Decatur, Tennessee, from a Republican to a Democrat. Now, I say...
So maybe it's not quite the conspiracy we thought, or maybe the Democrats have figured out how easy they are to hack as well. Brad,
well, listen, all along I've said the things don't work, and I don't care who they're flipping to. Get them the hell out of service.
Yeah, let's just go to paper. Give me a piece of paper. As you know, here in Oregon, I'm going to fill out a piece of paper. Tragically, it's going to be scanned on an ESNS optical scanner, but we got to fix that. But that's a whole other issue.
At least there's a record of the voter intent. There is no record.
That's
of
right.
Voter intent on a touchscreen machine, with or without these so-called paper trails.
That's
period.
Right.
There's no
that's
way
right.
to know.
And that's and by the way, this vote flipping. This is a good reason. If you have a cell phone that is capable of doing a little bit of video, not just take a picture for that matter too, but in particular if it'll run 30 seconds of video.
Yeah.
When you vote, take your cell phone into that voting booth with you, and if you've got a small portable video camera, video your vote. And because I tell you, the first time we get a couple of good pieces of video that look like that Homer Simpson clip, they're going to go viral, and it's going to bring this thing down.
Yeah, and one of the people, by the way, who had their vote slipped down in Nashville were the filmmakers of the documentary Uncounted.
Right. I know. I reported the story 2 days ago.
So, I mean, it's but now I'm hoping now that it's flipping from Republicans to Democrats, maybe something will actually get done. In 2006, when Rick Santorum in his Senate race in Pennsylvania had reports of these machines being flipping, the GOP down there called to impound every one of those machines and get them out of service. Democrats need to be doing that too, and they need to be raising holy hell right now to make sure there will be enough paper ballots, because I promise you, these machines are going down. And I'm worried that people won't be able to vote on anything because they're going to run out of paper, period.
So real quickly, we've got 45 seconds. Brad Friedman, bradblog.com. What can and should we all do to make sure that our vote gets counted?
You made a good point. Bring in your video camera to tape what's going on and tape when you're voting on these machines. Go over to standingforvoters.org and force your candidate to sign the no concessions pledge right here and right now. And frankly, you gotta raise holy hell with the Democrats and Obama that they start taking this stuff seriously, because they are not. Make sure they demand there are enough paper ballots for every voter in this country, and get these touchscreens the hell out of service immediately.
Yeah, very, very well said. And absentee voting?
Well, if you can, if you're living where there's your only choice is touchscreen, then absentee is fine. But the best thing is a paper ballot on election day.
Right. So when you show up and they say the machine's over there, you can say, "I'll take a piece of paper, please."
You can in many states. So learn what you're allowed to do in your particular state and get that paper ballot if you're allowed to.
There you go. And you can get all the information over at bradblog.com. And Brad has links to all the other sites out there that had to do with election protection as well. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Tom.
57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, fighting for the common man and the common good and the common woman. Here we all are in this together. Oh, my. Orrin Hatch. Yeah, this is so sad. I mean, this is just so sad. These guys, they're so desperate. Here's Orrin Hatch talking about America hasn't lost its standing abroad. The world is just jealous.
Barack Obama just moments ago was talking about our standing in the world. He believes that the United States has declined in its world standing and that he wants to get that back. Do you believe that that's really true?
Well, there's a lot of jealousy about the United States, especially in Europe and France in particular, and some of the other nations as well.
Oh, they're just so jealous of us. They want our health care system where you can die waiting to get in to see a doctor.
And so naturally, they're constantly poking holes at the United States. But boy, there's a lot of respect for this country. They know that if the United States is not doing well, the world's not going to do well. Yeah, there's some irritation with the United States, but mainly it's because we're so powerful and strong militarily, economically, and otherwise.
Yeah, maybe they're afraid of shock and awe, although I don't think, frankly, the French even these days are all that afraid of that. But bizarre, absolutely bizarre. And I shared with you earlier the quote from Alan Greenspan. Here's the actual audio. This is Greenspan's...
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
Greenspan's Casablanca moment, speaking before Congress this morning.
We are in the midst of a once-in-a-century credit tsunami. Central banks and governments are being required to take unprecedented measures. As I wrote last March, those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself especially, are in a state of shocked disbelief. Such counterparty surveillance is a central pillar of our financial market state of balance. If it fails, as occurred this year, market stability is undermined.
And this is the essence of what William Seidman was talking about when he was talking about how Greenspan was really pushing this thing. And it's just, it's, you know, the whole risk thing. And his conversations about Greenspan. Greenspan believed in Ayn Rand. I mean, he absolutely believed in Ayn Rand. This is William Seidman, who is the guy who was the former head of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and was when they created the Resolution Trust Corporation, the RTC, to bring the savings and loans to bail out $342 billion that it cost you and me, the taxpayers, to bail out, you know, John McCain's son's SNL and George Bush's brother's SNL and so on. Here's William Seidman. He speaks for himself.
It was proposed that their regulation, or at least disclosure, be required.
Now, actually, I need to explain that, what he was talking about. So let me. He was talking about how he had invented
tranching and subprime the subprime mortgages. Okay. In fact, he says that, you know, he says, I take responsibility for it. He invented it. Hey, let me back up to this one here.
The subprime mortgage market grew in a way that is almost impossible to believe. There were almost 2 million subprime mortgages written in a year and a half. That means somebody had to finance a couple million homes almost of subprime mortgages. So why did anybody put their money in this? Why would anybody, knowing that these people, subprime means that they are not prime? Well, the genesis of that goes back to something called securitization and something called tranched, credit-rated securitization. Now, that was invented by one of the people who were operating in the RTC, and namely, it was invented by me and our group.
So William Seaman, the guy who invented these instruments. So then he goes to Greenspan and he says, okay, we've invented this way of bundling these mortgages that we've inherited through these failed SNLs. This is during the first Bush administration, when the first bank failure happened during the first Bush administration. And he says, as a result of the Reagan deregulation of the SNLs. So he says, we've invented this way of bundling these mortgages and then tranching them and then cutting them into slices and selling off those slices. The problem is, because it's not a classic security, it's not regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And because it's not insurance or something like that, it's not regulated by, there's no regulation. We don't even know how many there are. And he goes to Greenspan with this, and so this is where Seidman is talking about that. This is the guy who founded the, created the Resolution Trust Corporation, ran it until it was done, and before that was chairman of the FDIC. A good Republican, by the way, a lifelong Republican, who has endorsed John McCain in the election reluctantly because he's a Republican.
It was proposed that their regulation, or at least disclosure, be required. And the industry fought it, and the Federal Reserve, under Alan Greenspan, vehemently opposed. And they made the argument, which you hear all the time, and I can remember Alan and saying, look, these are sophisticated contracts between knowledgeable buyers and knowledgeable sellers. No regulator can do as well as they'll do. So what do you need a regulator for? The market will regulate these. And he won the day. So among the list of our friends, along with me and others, Alan was clearly, I'd say, the key person responsible for the fact that we didn't even know how many of those contracts there were. And they were up in the trillions. So when AIG got in trouble, it turned out that they had one division with 400 people in it. They had 80,000 employees. They had 400 people in one division. They wrote all these contracts. They didn't report any of them. So they were, you'd say, gambling by writing these contracts. And when things started to go bad and they had to pay on these contracts, the whole monster, the largest insurance company in the world, went under.
There you go. So this is the genesis of the whole thing. And here, again, you have Greenspan saying he's just, you know, he's shocked by this because he thought that the market would regulate itself. He really and truly believed this ideology that Ayn Rand had preached when he, in 1956, went to her apartment in New York City and became a disciple of hers. He spent 10 years with her. And it's, I mean, This is the genesis of the whole thing. This is, and in fact, Seidman talks about Greenspan being involved with this whole thing, and I think this is particularly telling.
What is tranched credit-rated securitization? What it simply means is you take a bunch of mortgages, you put them into a trust, and then you divide the trust up into sections, and you say the first section, all the mortgages will support payment of interest on the first section. And then after they're paid, you go to the second, then the third, and then there's a residual piece. That is the way that these mortgages, subprime mortgages, were put together, and then these pieces were sold all over the world. I remember when we invented this, Alan Greenspan said, well, this is a great new innovation because we are spreading the risk all over the world, which, of course, is what we did, and for which, at this point, the world is, to say the least, blaming the whole financial crisis we're in on us.
And who do we blame it on?
As I wrote last March, those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself especially, are in a state of shocked disbelief. Such counterparty surveillance is a central pillar of our financial market state of balance.
By central party, he's talking about sophisticated buyers and sophisticated sellers with sophisticated instruments. This is the free market. This is a central pillar of our philosophy.
If it fails, as occurred this year, market stability is undermined.
Yes, and it did fail, Alan, and it failed predictably because this ideology of libertarianism, of Ayn Randism, of objectivism, of simply let the market do whatever it wants, is always going to crash and burn. And it certainly did this case. Laissez-faire capitalism, hopefully now, has a stake driven through its heart. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Sarah Palin, asked by Brian Williams. This is amazing. Palin stumped when Brian Williams asked her to explain preconditions. Now, keep in mind, a precondition is exactly that. It is a condition that precedes a meeting. In other words, say, I will meet you, but only in a public place. That would be, for example, a precondition, you know, that individuals could have. Or I will meet you, but only if you promise me that, or only if you show up, you know, with your clothing on or something. I don't know. You can come up with strange things. But anyway, so he asked her about preconditions.
Governor Palin, yesterday you tied this notion of an early test to the new president with this notion of preconditions,
right,
that you both have been hammering the Obama campaign on. What, first of all, what in your mind is a precondition?
You have to have some diplomatic strategy going into a meeting with someone like Ahmadinejad or Kim Jong-il, one of these dictators that would seek to destroy America or her allies. It is so naive and so dangerous for a presidential candidate to just proclaim that they would be willing to sit down with a leader like Ahmadinejad and just talk about the problems, the issues that are facing them. So that's some ill-preparedness right there.
Oh, so a precondition is preparation? I don't know. This is getting frightening. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Woody in Litchfield Park, Arizona. Hey, Woody, what's on your mind today?
Well, good morning, but I just wanted to share with you in the Washington Post, there was an article today about John McCain and the Keating Five and how it redeemed him. And in that, he, part of his rationale was that he used Alan Greenspan's positive take on Charles Keating as to why nobody could see what was going on. And that goes back to 87 and 89.
Yeah.
You know, Ravi Batra wrote this book called Greenspan's Fraud. And frankly, as that book is enough of an indictment, in my opinion, to get Greenspan impeached and possibly imprisoned. But it doesn't even get into that. I mean, you know, in some ways it just scratches the surface. And because much of this stuff is just now coming out. Woody, thanks for the heads up on that. That is just absolutely incredible. Scott in Westminster, Maryland. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing? One thing that struck me, I forget what the guy's name who was talking when he said subprime means not prime. That was the total statement of the obvious of the year. But I did want to comment about the American dream. I want to say right. that for me, I feel like it's slipping away. I went to college and graduated. I didn't go to a big college. I went to Salisbury University on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. But I had to pay for it on my own and take out student loans. And, you know, now I'm $30,000 in debt. And, I went to in a field, you know, knowing that I wouldn't make a lot of money. I'm in the social work field. And, you know, the most I can really make is $12, $13 an hour. And, you know, it just doesn't pay the bills. Fortunately, I'm married and I have somebody else to share the bills and the responsibility with. But, you know, if I was on my own, I wouldn't be able to make it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the really tough thing. Scott, thank you very much for sharing that with us. And I'm telling you, the social work field is having a real challenge right now. The Salem Children's Village that Louise and I started is hitting some bumpy roads. And if you are inclined to donate to a good charity, go to SalemChildrensVillage.org, and you can check that out. I think it's a fine charity, and they really could use some help right now. Peter in Portland. Hey, Peter. Thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's on your mind?
Hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about the issue of corporate responsibility that you touched on earlier.
Yeah.
First, I wanted to mention that I graduated from Georgetown Law in 97, and I've run my own LLCs and S-Corps ever since then.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the 1886 Supreme Court case, which corporations' personhood.
Right.
The other big issue with corporations is the race to the bottom, which we're seeing play out now. That's because state law governs corporations. They're in a competition to reduce costs and increase their margins, regardless of the cost to their workers and to our country's best interests. And I would submit that the only way to deal with this is to force corporations to pay their fair share, pay living wages, and provide adequate health care, and then to act as a responsible component of society through the federalization of corporate law.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I don't think that would be considered constitutional, but in 1952, 32% of all federal tax revenues, or all tax revenues, federal and state combined, 32% came from corporate taxes. Last year, it was 7%.
I understand
so
that.
We've got a big problem here. But let me tell you, this all started out with John D. Rockefeller in the 1880s and 1890s,
sure.
And what was called the charter-mongering era. It used to be that every state in the nation had laws against corporations basically rising up and usurping rights. The corporations could only exist for 30 to 40 years, and then they had to be dissolved and reincorporated.
Right.
That they couldn't own other corporations.
Right.
That they couldn't have, that they could only do one particular type of business, and if you wanted to do something else, you had to start another corporation. In other words, you couldn't have these giant combines and monopolies.
Right.
All of that stuff got blown apart when John D. Rockefeller was prosecuted successfully in Ohio for violations of the antitrust laws, the state antitrust laws, and he said, okay, what state is willing to change its charter? And New Jersey said, we will, and New York said, we will, and Delaware said, we will, and Connecticut said, we will. And you had this rush to the bottom in the 1890s, the charter-mongering era, where states rewrote their laws about corporations so Rockefeller could have his way.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Past the hour. fair and slightly unbalanced. It's the Tom Hartman Show. That's me, Christy Harvey, with us. She is the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website, and, of course, Mike Check Radio, MikeCheckRadio.org, with our news that has slid under the radar of the corporate media. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I'm fine. How's Alaska treating you?
Alaska's going pretty well. I went on my first glacier hike over the weekend.
Really?
I did, yeah, the Matanuska Glacier, which is about 2 hours north of Anchorage.
Uh-huh.
And it was fantastic, but a little hint in case you ever go on one, when you hear the wolf pack start to howl, that's a good time to turn around.
Really?
That's what we decided to do.
Wow. I've been on glaciers in Europe. There's one in Switzerland where they've actually carved, not quite a little city, but this whole area out of a glacier. But they're starting to melt like crazy. I mean, they're getting very concerned about it in the European glaciers.
They are everywhere. There was even a new report that made me think of this when I was on the glacier. There's a new report by the World Wildlife Fund that came out late last week and then is getting more play this week because it's going to be in one of the nature journals. But they found that climate change is happening, quote, faster, stronger, and sooner than scientists previously thought. And they cited the Arctic Ocean as a specific example, saying that the sea there is losing ice about 30 years ahead of what the previous predictions had been. So it is a big problem.
Wow, that's a tough one. And that's going to cause more problems, more flood victims, more disaster victims. And here in the United States, we have this wonderful organization. Actually, under the Clinton administration, it was a damn good organization.
Oh, absolutely.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, also known as FEMA. And George W. Bush came in, and as is the case right across the board, the Republicans view government as an opportunity to enrich their buddies rather than an opportunity to serve the people. And so he put Brownie in charge of FEMA. And apparently Brownie's legacy and those like him before him and after him continues to echo through the agency.
Oh, my goodness. This one, I actually thought of you when I read this because my head just started to explode all over the living room yesterday. So you remember the FEMA trailers? We talked about this a lot last year. FEMA had put
the formaldehyde-infested trailers.
Exactly. They had these toxic levels of formaldehyde. Pets were dying. Children were having bloody noses and asthma attacks and respiratory failures. And it was a big problem. And at the time, FEMA found out about it and said, don't test anything. The second we test, we're on the hook to fix it. And then the CDC suppressed reports from scientists saying that there were toxic levels of formaldehyde in these trailers. And it finally broke in CBS News, and they got all the trailers back. They sold them for 40 cents on the dollar, realized they weren't supposed to do that, bought them all back at original price, said they would never use them, though, but then decided to use them.
Mm-hmm.
So the news story, if you can believe there's still news stories on this case, CBS News decided to test some of the trailers that were sent to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, after the big floods up there.
The big floods of a few months ago, month ago.
Exactly. The floods back in June and July left a lot of people without homes.
Right.
And so that's what FEMA does, is provide homes to people who've lost their residences from natural disasters. And they tested 20 of these trailers and found that in every single one of these 20 trailers, the formaldehyde levels exceeded FEMA's own standards for formaldehyde. And FEMA standards aren't even as strong as other standards. They just blew all these away. The levels were way too high. So they went to FEMA and they said, here's the deal. The trailers are still poisoned. You've put new people in these poisoned trailers. What are you going to do? And FEMA said, it's not our fault. We bet that the formaldehyde levels are high because of the lifestyles of the people who are living there.
Oh, you mean like they're smoking formaldehyde cigarettes, or they're drinking formaldehyde-laced booze? Or
just throwing formaldehyde into the air for a party or
something.
Yeah,
maybe using it for cologne.
Well, the first thing they said was smoking can raise formaldehyde levels. And they said, well, we only tested trailers where nobody smoked. And then they said, well, it's still not our fault. You know, formaldehyde levels can go up if people store dry cleaning chemicals. How are we to know they weren't storing dry cleaning chemicals in these trailers?
Right, like everybody has a 30,000-pound dry cleaning unit stashed in the back of their house.
Well, that's the first thing I do when I lose everything in a flood is go out and buy a lot of dry cleaning chemicals to just store in my new trailer. I know, it's absolutely ridiculous. So they actually pointed to some of these children. There were infants and toddlers that were having these bloody noses in these formaldehyde trailers in Iowa. And they told FEMA about this, and the FEMA spokesman said, and this is a direct quote, "Hey, if you have a health concern and you want to move out of the housing, you're free to move out of the housing."
To where?
Didn't say. Yeah. With what money? Didn't say. Right. You know, these are people who have lost everything. You know, they're starting from scratch, and that's why they have these trailers. And instead of saying, "Oh, my goodness, we've given you a poisoned place for you and your children to live," instead they said, "It's your problem, and if it's not your problem, it's definitely not our problem. Get over it."
And not only have they lost everything, but the vast majority of these people, you look at some of these profiles, the vast majority of these people are badly in debt, as are most Americans. I mean, they still owe, they owe money on houses that have been swept away and destroyed. They have credit card debt because that's the new norm in America. The average American family now has, is $7,900 in debt to just on credit cards. And I mean, they were just skating by. So many of these people were just skating by on debt, you know, courtesy of Alan Greenspan and cheap and easy debt over the last 26 years and Reaganomics. And so they've lost everything. They're in the hole. And we come along and say, "We will help you. We will help us," basically. I mean, mm-hmm. you'd think that this is the standard by which Americans would be proud of themselves as Americans. And under the Bush administration, FEMA is telling people that they're, you know, just tough luck, Charlie. This is tragic, Christy.
And also think about it, Tom. I don't want to stereotype anyone, but it's not like FEMA's putting people up in penthouse apartments. You know, it's not like people are choosing to just stay in these fairly crappy little FEMA trailers because they want to.
Yeah,
you know, these are people who don't have the option to go out and move into a new condo.
Right,
you know, they're people who need to put it back together first.
Yeah, it's not like FEMA is buying them $150,000 worth of new clothes at Neiman Marcus and Saks Fifth Avenue.
Exactly.
so that their 7-year-old daughter can walk around with a, Louis Vuitton bag.
Right,
you know.
Right.
Amazing.
Good point.
Yeah. Okay. Earlier this week, Politico reported that the RNC spent $150,000 on this. Didn't McCain once have something to say about using political contributions to buy clothes?
Oh, exactly. And everyone's trying to figure out if this is legal or not. And I think what they've come down to is the $150,000 is legal, but just barely. And John McCain himself, when he was big into campaign finance reform, remember, back in the 90s, he was, you know, considered a hero.
He was trying to make good from the Keating Five is what he was trying to do.
Well, exactly. There is that. But he fought against allowing campaign funds to be used for personal purposes. And in 1993, he stood on the floor of the Senate and he specifically denounced this. And he said, "Madam President, the amendment before the Senate is a simple one. It restricts the use of campaign funds for inherently personal purposes. It would restrict individuals for using them for things as home mortgage payments, clothing payments, vacations and trips, or other non-campaign, things that are non-campaign in nature."
Right.
So he knew it was wrong back in the 90s, and he was against it and fought it until he needed it. And then, you know, then comes the blind eye.
Right. Right. Interesting. Now, ABC News weighed in on this.
Yes. And ABC News, Jake Tapper does a lot with their blog, and he's very good. And he went and talked to a tax law expert in Washington who didn't want to be named, but talked to the experts in the field and came back to Jake and said, you know, "This is what I think. This is what all of my high finance tax law buddies think. But that Sarah Palin is going to have to pay taxes on these clothes because it's specifically income." Now, the RNC says it's just a loan. We're going to get the clothes back after the campaign and donate them to charity. But there's some legal thing where if the product that you loan loses value, you know, like worn shoes, then you can't technically claim it as a complete loan. You have to, it's all very technical and legal, but the bottom line is they're saying it's depreciated, and they are saying that they are going to probably have to pay taxes on this whopping $150,000 worth of clothes bought in 2 months. Did you know that's what the average family spends in 80 years on clothing?
80 years. Wow.
80 years.
That's incredible. No, I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm a guy who buys, you know, like two pairs of jeans a year, and that's about it. It's but the
I probably more information than you wanted to know.
I'm sure they're very nice jeans.
Yeah. I'm just not into clothes. But and I totally forgot where I was going with that. Oh, I remember this whole idea of Sarah Palin. I mean, you know, it's coming out now that she had the state of Alaska pay $20,000 to schlep her kids, to fly her kids to New York City and put them up in fancy hotels when she was there, you know, lobbying and things. I mean, apparently she has stuck the state of Alaska with some substantial bills that now a few folks are scratching their heads about.
Yeah, and the thing is, Alaska, since I've been here, I've seen even just in the past few weeks, a definite change in how the people that I've met and talked to who have been here for years and years see their governor. And at first everybody was sort of excited, you know, hometown girl
sure.
makes good and goes on the national stage. But it's really interesting, you know, as many people as you talk to now say that she's changed, she's become fake, she's become materialistic. And when she comes back in November, she's probably going to have a tough time reestablishing herself as a viable political person here in Alaska.
Well, it's really going to be interesting now that you're there and on the ground and you can give us the updates to get that story.
Absolutely.
Christy, thanks so much. Christy Harvey, Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Great talking to you, Christy.
Thanks, Tom.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Paycheck just ain't stretching like it might have once before. Cause good jobs are all gone, left you in some big box store. Between food and rent and medicine, seems the suit's frayed a little bit more. When the boss cut that last corner, they walk out on those doors. When the truckers hauling sweatshop stuff won't stop there anymore. When the folks won't cross your pickets cause their folks the same as yours. That is one big union.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. They're spinning so hard trying to get away from this Sarah Palin $150,000 worth of clothes. So the official Republican response is...
Tell you this, you know what the outrage is today? Is Barack Obama's taking a 767 campaign plane to go visit grandma. Forget about the energy that is wasted. What about the hundreds of thousands of dollars to take a private trip when this guy should be humping his bags on a commercial plane or taking a smaller plane? Taking a 767 of campaign money from people who could least afford it is more of an outrage, in my opinion.
That is one of the most valiant tries I have ever seen in this entire debate over Sarah Palin's clothing allowance. Nice try, Brad.
Nice try, Brad. In fact, the matter is, you know, take for a presidential candidate to take a commercial plane is simply not a reasonable thing. And if you try to fly across the Pacific Ocean to Hawaii in anything smaller than a 757, you are going to end up in the water. Ellen Radner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, how you doing?
Well, yes, and there's also the issue of security.
That was my point. That's why he can't take a commercial plane.
Exactly. It's not just whatever, not just logistics. Okay, well, we had some testimony before Congress today and government oversight, one of them House government oversight. Alan Greenspan, I got to give him credit for one thing. He is honest. At least he seems honest today. And he said that this is a once-in-a-century great credit tsunami. He said that he and others were shocked. They were really quite shocked. They had faith in the lending institutions. He was asked by Congressman Waxman about whether he still believed that banks could regulate themselves, and he said that he originally thought that banks could do that, but he does not. And he said that he still does not understand how this happened. He said it was a grim outlook on the jobs front. And that there will be a significant rise in layoffs. He says the crisis will end when home prices stabilize, and that may not be for a while. And then he said that whatever regular, this is very interesting, he said whatever regulation changes are made on the federal level, they will pale by what has already happened in terms of sort of public information and the information that has come out.
Right. I think actually I have the audio here of Mr. Greenspan.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
There you go.
Okay. Also, the Treasury representative who's now dealing with this says that they are making some progress in terms of liquidity in the markets. He said the market is very, very fragile. Then the head of the FDIC was up before Congress today. She said that she is closely and creatively working with the Treasury Department. Her plan is to somehow get loan guarantees for mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
The Treasury Department is saying that her idea is being looked at very seriously, but nobody has put that into implementation.
Yeah, it seems to me that what we have to do is wring all this excess kind of created overnight phony wealth out of the home system, and the only way to do that is to give people the legal authority, and for that matter, banks. I mean, banks are just going to have to take these as losses. They put them on their books in the first place, stupidly. They're the ones who are ultimately responsible for it, and people should have the power to renegotiate their mortgages so that their mortgage now reflects actual value, market value of their house, and let the banks take the beating. I don't see any other way to do it. I mean, that's essentially what was done by Franklin Roosevelt.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously everything's going to be reevaluated, and we're dealing with a deflationary situation.
That's
here,
right.
Particularly on home values. And the dollar goes up, but as one economist said, that is not necessarily good for the economy.
Right. The dollar went up a lot from 1929 to 1934. It went up a lot. It became, you know, dollars became much more valuable. In fact, it became basically, you know, cash was king was the phrase from that era. And,
right.
And people were desperate to have dollars in any case. Yeah. So what else is going on?
Okay. That is really sort of a big focus. One of the things that Congress is taking a look at is this United States Iraq Security Initiative. And there is some talk that they would like to have congressional ratification in the next administration for this agreement. Supposedly it is not a treaty, so it doesn't need it, but there's a lot of talk that people are going to want it.
Hmm. Interesting.
The president is also getting ready for that big meeting on the 15th. White House is saying it usually takes them a year, and it is, of course, I think I talked about it yesterday, the G20. That includes places like India. It's a very different group of people, and what they are planning on doing are these kind of working groups to really push ahead and figure out what they can do to stabilize the world economy, which, as you know, is a very serious issue. I just was at a United Nations luncheon that Ban Ki-moon spoke at for reporters, and it was an awards luncheon, and he is saying that one of the things, he's actually meeting with Bill Clinton at the White House, at the UN today, and he said that they're very worried about the pledges for poverty in the world because member nations just don't have the money.
Right, yeah. This is the most poor and vulnerable are going to take the biggest hit, tragically. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, great news source. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And you're invited to brunch with Bernie tomorrow. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here with all the latest news from D.C. Plus, he'll take your calls and answer your questions. And it's Anything Goes Friday. So anything you want to talk about. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. VideoYourVote.org. Check it out. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.